Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is someone you could say has definitely earned his stripes. He was president and CEO of Sony Interactive Entertainment America and chairman of PlayStation Worldwide Studios. But as of late, he is enjoying retirement, which is well earned. I'd like to welcome Sean Layden.
Hey, Reese. Good morning to you.
Thanks for taking time out doing this.
Yeah, and thanks for making me sound like just only one foot in the grave and not the whole body there.
Well, you still seem alive and well.
Thank you very much.
Still high energy. I don't know if it's coffee or just it's all natural.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you do a lot of these, so I'm hoping we can try and tread some new ground to make this a bit more interesting for you.
Okay.
Time is a precious commodity, as they say, so I want to make the most of it, but what I wanted to ask first off is in regards to PlayStation's naming conventions, because it seems out of all the big players in terms of the console manufacturers, they all tried to use weird or quirky names, but you guys stuck with this simple numbering system. Was that always the plan?
Well, the plan was just to be successful with the PlayStation.
Well, you know, yes, of course.
That was the plan. You don't plan the numbering system while you're still launching the first original console. I think, and once we got there and we had good traction, surprisingly, with our original PlayStation offering, and the fans seemed to take to it. We looked at the need to have a sequel, if you will, you know, a second act to that show. And I think PlayStation 2 was just a natural naming convention coming out of Sony, right? Because I remember when we had the Walkman, then we had Walkman 2. And with so many product lines and so many areas that the company is active in, really just numbering them seemed the easier way to go. You know, a lot of Sony products are still, you know, known as SCPH-5000 or those types of naming conventions. It's a very electronic thing. I think the other console manufacturers were trying to mix it up by giving different names to every generation of product. But in the end, it also makes it difficult to track where you are on the evolutionary spline of a thing. So,
agreed.
PlayStation 2 is the successor to PlayStation 1. It's axiomatic almost. But in other conventions with other companies, it's difficult to know, did this come before that one? Or where was this one in the line of evolution? So it was a simple answer, a simple outcome, and I think it worked well for PlayStation.
Well, I think sometimes marketing departments try to be too clever for their own good.
Oh, really? You think?
We've got to come up with this cool name.
Oh, precisely. Precisely. Yeah. We probably had more of that with the handhelds. We went from PSP to PlayStation Vita. We had PSP Go. We had a bit more, you know, lateral movement with the naming conventions around those platforms. But in the end, it's really about what does the game deliver? What does the console deliver? Whether it's handheld or in the home, marketing departments try to put their stamp on everything that comes across the door. Sometimes you just need a strong driving leader, someone like Ken Kutaragi, to take decision making out of your hands, because he made all decisions himself.
Yeah, good answer. One of the things I love about your career is that you've had a lot of these sink or swim moments where you're kind of gone through this baptism by fire, where you're kind of just handed something and you had no idea how to deal with it at the time. But I'm wondering if when you're thrust into these sort of situations, whether you relish those type of moments, or at least initially, if there's like some sort of imposter syndrome, whether it was in regards to game development or marketing or all the various different jobs that you did over the years.
Well, anyone who leads an effort or leads a team or leads a company, if they don't have at least a modicum of imposter syndrome, they're not doing it right. I mean, that's one of the things that keeps you motivated, that keeps you moving, that keeps you learning. You know, a little bit of that, really, do I know everything I need to know, or am I really the right person to be in this spot? It forces you to lean in even harder to pick up all the different nuances and information you may not have already. My career has been a lot of situations where it was, this thing's broken, can you fix it? And that's a great moment to be in. You know, you want to be in any sort of business, you want to be seen as the person who can come in and solve other people's problems. If you get a reputation for doing that, then I think you have a good chance for success in the operation. So the other half of that is a question I used to ask people when I interviewed them for jobs. Okay, final question on your job interview. If you had an opportunity to be head of the fire department or chief architect on the Golden Gate Bridge, which job would you prefer? And it gives an idea of what kind of things motivate a person. For me personally, I'd rather be the head of the fire department. You know, every day is a new fire. Every day it's a new exciting moment. Every day is a new problem to be solved. The architect of the Golden Gate Bridge, you have a long-term horizon. You get to plan it out. You get to control certain factors over time, which is rewarding in its own sort of way. But I prefer sort of the instant moment where decisions have to be made, and it has a lot of consequence around it. So yeah, adrenaline junkie, maybe that's the answer to your question.
Yeah, but you didn't actually advocate for a lot of the roles you ended up being in. It was a result of people coming to you and being like, hey, you want to do this? And you just jumped at the chance.
Well, hey, we have this broken thing over here. You want to fix that? Yeah, it was opportunity. It was I've spoken to other podcasts about this, about my trajectory in Sony for 32 years in the company. I only ever applied for one job with the first one I got
Yeah, that's right.
in the PR department. And then again, you just make a reputation for yourself of someone who can go in. Isn't when some people ask you for help, always give it if you can. If people want you to join into a project, don't let your first question be what's in it for me, but what can I add to this team to make it effective and do better? So it gave me a lot of opportunity to do different things. I mean, I worked in Tokyo, London, and San Francisco. It's I could have asked for a better trajectory on across the places you could spend your career. But a lot of time it was here. We've just bought this studio in England called Cygnosis. How are we going to integrate this asset into the studios? Go out there and try to do that. Come back and say, we've got this issue in Japan with PlayStation 3 sales and marketing. Can you come to Japan and be CEO of the Japan project? It's like, yep, okay, we can do that. And latterly, things like we had to take the PlayStation Network offline in a moment's notice when we had the hack in 20, gosh, how was it? 2011, I guess it was.
And you were doing 18-hour
And
days.
oh, yeah, everyone was. It wasn't just me, everybody was. But the thing about a crisis of that magnitude, like your entire network goes down, the one thing it provides is clarity. Every day you wake up, you only have one job. Get the network back up. Everything else is secondary, tertiary, or not important at all. If the network doesn't come back up, nothing else matters. So, you know, it provides a little ease of purpose, I think, in those sorts of moments.
But if you're not getting much sleep during that time, how are you supposed to be effective? Because if you don't get enough sleep, then your eyesight starts to become blurry. You're probably seeing spots. I don't know if that was happening while you were dealing with the hack.
I was a younger man then, so it was a bit more manageable. But yeah, there's a lot of sleeping on the sofa, you know, in between. Oh, they're going to call back in an hour. Okay, great. I get 45 minutes kip. And it's commando rules, right? Eat when you can, sleep when you can, and you get your way through it. The interesting thing about a crisis like that is you also get to know the metal of your team, the makeup of your team. You know, who are the ones that are going to jump into the breach, and who are the ones that may not have the energy or courage or motivation to jump into the breach. So yeah, it's a defining moment for a lot of people.
Yeah, I suppose it would be. And you'd learn a
Yeah.
lot about yourself, I suppose, in terms of how much you can handle on your plate. Yeah.
How much you can handle, you get to
Stress
learn how much you can
management.
ask other people to do.
Delegating,
You know,
yeah.
you can't push people beyond their limit. But everyone's actual limit is like 10% further than they think it is. If you can just give them the help to get across that. And some people you just know they just can't be active or helpful in that situation. You've got to make those decisions pretty quick too.
Fair enough. When you first got into the marketing side, what did you discover in terms of marketing in terms of what the most important aspect is? Because Sony is by far, I feel, the most dominant when it comes to marketing out of the big three from a global standpoint.
Well, indeed, and that's the well, let's be honest, we get to stand on the shoulders of giants. Akio Morita and Masaru Iibuka, who created Sony back in 1946. They started the company very small, grew it to a global powerhouse that it became, and a lot of it was based on marketing. You know, Sony decided early in its career, in its genesis, that the Japanese market was pretty stuffed. So for them to be successful, it was going to rely on overseas markets. They were the first big electronics manufacturer in Japan to go overseas. They were the first Japanese company listed on the New York Stock Exchange. They saw the importance of being out in the marketplace and to be effective there. One of the things that Morita-san used to say is, you know, we have to market locally. We have a global vision for the company, but on the ground where the rubber meets the road, we have to have local people, local executives in country who can tell that story to the consumers in that region. So marketing became a very important focus for the company. Mortensen had a gift for it. The idea of the Walkman was more marketing than it was technology. And PlayStation builds upon that DNA that was part of Sony Corp. So marketing was always important, how we tell the story. I think you might remember back in PlayStation 1 when we came out, our ads were insane. The TV commercials were like nothing anyone had ever seen, largely because of the Japan DNA in there, because when Sony created the PlayStation Group called Sony Computer Entertainment at the time, it was a joint venture between Sony Electronics and Sony Music. The company knew that just being an electronics powerhouse wasn't enough to make you a game successful in the game business. So half the company came from Sony Music, which included publishing, advertising, marketing. So we began PlayStation 1, different from Sega and Nintendo. We were marketing games and studios like rock bands, like new releases of songs or new releases of games. The advertising campaign was like nothing they'd seen before. And that carried on in Europe with crazy ads for Wipeout. And that whole David Lynch thing, our rest in peace, Mr. Lynch. He did the PlayStation, the third way PlayStation crazy ads that were like something right out of a fever dream from Twin Peaks. And that hit the market pretty well. So the company has always tried to do marketing different, try to tell a story to a wider audience through a different angle and not just, here's the game, here's the selling points, here's a single player or multiplayer, buy it, thanks. There's a lot more mystery to it back then. And I think the PlayStation had a lot of, should take a lot of credit for changing the way that the game advertising thing is seen today.
Well, especially in places like Europe and Australasia, where it almost seems like PlayStation land. Like it's just so dominant there. And a lot of it has to do with the marketing and you penetrating that market early on in a more aggressive way compared to your competitors,
Yeah, and you remember with
even still
Wipeout?
today.
Remember the game Wipeout from PS1? I mean, that was the first time we really blended the music experience with the game experience. For a lot of people, it's the first time they heard of the Crystal Method or the Chemical Brothers or Prodigy or any of the bands that we had back then on the soundtrack. They were putting copies of, they were putting PlayStation kiosks in nightclubs in London for like chilling out. You got your EDM experience over there, then you go in the chill out room and just play PlayStation games there. It became a lifestyle thing rather than just a hobby for teenagers.
How much does FOMO play into marketing?
Oh, it's a lot. It's a lot. I mean, it's all FOMO, isn't it? Good marketing is all trying to create the desire for the thing you don't have right now, or the feeling that everybody else is doing this cool thing and you're not, and that's somehow bad for you. I think at every level, marketing is some kind of FOMO generator in order to get people in.
And there's varying
And
degrees of FOMO as to what
yep.
somebody's FOMO level is.
Yep. That fear of missing out. The big driver is the first word, fear. Fear is the driver. It's like, oh my God, everyone's doing this cool thing and I'm not. I need to get in there. And I think not just game marketing, but marketing overall is largely built on the back of that, whether you're selling video games or jeans or, some new weight loss drug.
Did that kind of play into the strategy of moving to PC, like to create FOMO? So, because it was your idea, right? You're the one that pushed for
A lot
PlayStation
of people had
games.
the idea, but yes, it was on my watch where I decided we're going to do this thing.
Right. Was there an initial pushback?
Oh yeah, a lot of pushback. I mean, there was a time back in PlayStation 1 where we had a game called Jet Moto and a game called Warhawk, and the studios wanted to publish them on PC. And at the time, Kutaragi-san rightly felt that Sony Computer Entertainment would not be in the PC publishing business. So I actually had to spin that off into another group in order to publish into the PC market, which wasn't really big back then in the late 90s. So it didn't really have a lot of impact, and most people don't remember that happened. But latterly, the reason why I thought we should go onto PC, and again, after a year, once a game's in the market,
Initial
because
release,
once a game's in the market for a year, you can look at the de decay rate. It's not going to cannibalize sales. It's already s sold to your console market that wants it. PC was not to make money, not to really generate FOMO so much as it was, I just want to introduce to people who are not in the PlayStation camp, these are the things we're doing. Check it out. It could be cool. My view was that the PC market wasn't going to come to PlayStation on its own. And for us to tell them the story of what our games are, we have to meet them where they are. And if you're on your PC, I will meet you where you are. Not on day one, on day 366, but it was more of a chance just to get IP and the brand out there to an audience which normally we don't have a chance to talk to.
That makes sense. But I imagine when GTA 6 releases, there will be PC players that do have FOMO and will probably end up buying a PS5 just to play it. So,
Yes, there are some titles that can actually change weather patterns. And Grand
yes.
Theft Auto is a franchise that can change weather patterns. Yes.
Yes, definitely so. And I wanted to ask about Astrobot because that was my game of the year last year. It was the Game Awards game of the year, and of course it was yours.
Yes.
But what is the reason as to why it was your game of the year?
Because it was fresh.
Yeah.
It was fresh. It. You remember back on PlayStation 1, when you talk about genre, the different categories of games, it was always like RPG, platformer, fighting game, racing game, action game. And over time, the main genre in gaming now is adventure and action sports. There's still some RPG stuff going on, but racing, fighting, platformers, those used to be the staple of like the PlayStation 1 and 2 generation.
Yeah.
And they've really reduced the number of offerings against that. I mean, in racing, it's Gran Turismo, and then there's Forza over there, and maybe there's a Need for Speed. I can't remember.
I think it's been a while.
In fighting games, if it's not Street Fighter or Tekken, I don't know what we're talking about. I mean, that's just pretty much it. No more Toshinden, Ballerina Toshinden. And platformers, it used to be the thing, right? It was Crash Bandicoot, Spyro the Dragon, Gex. Pandemonium, a whole bunch of different Rayman, and those have just kind of gone by the wayside. I mean, that's still Nintendo's bread and butter, but on the PlayStation platform, they're hard to find. And so Astrobot was kind of a callback to what we originally thought was the fun part of gaming, cruising through an environment, collecting stuff, powering up, seeing different things. It was played well with the families. You could sit down with your kids and play a game like Astrobot. And it was available in bite-sized chunks. So you didn't feel you had to sit down and do a 9-hour sesh to get to a meaningful point. You can just go through the levels and enjoy them for what they are. It was very nostalgic for me. And I think it was for a lot of people.
Well, yeah, I think adding in all the additional characters from Sony's IP definitely helped. But I think it
Right.
also validates what you've been saying for a good while now in terms of games being too long, right? Because it's, what, 12 to 15 hours, very condensed, immaculately polished, and well designed.
And you can go back again, and it's replayability. That's the other thing we used to talk about a lot in games 20 years ago, is does it have replayability? And I think something like Astrobot does.
Yeah. There's some sort of inherent quality I feel about the way the Japanese design games that the West just can't seem to emulate. I mean, you've spent quite a bit of time in Japan. I don't know what it is. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think, the Japanese gaming tradition, such as it is, Nintendo notwithstanding, came out of the arcade experience. That was the catch line for us with PlayStation 1, is the arcade in the home.
Yeah.
We'll bring 3D arcade gaming into your house. And so, it's built on the back of Ridge Racer and Tekken, and laterally things like Street Fighter, which came across from, the Sega platforms onto PlayStation. And the psychology or the design, a sensibility around building arcade games is really about how much fun for a 100 yen coin. I'm going to drop 100 yen in the slot. How much fun should, as a player, I expect to have, and as a developer, how much should I feel good to give? If it's not enough, they won't drop another coin. If it's too much, they won't drop another coin. But if it's just in the right space, the classic, Tekken, you finish your battle, then it goes continue 9, 8, 7, and you reach for that coin and you just drop it in the slot. And that's how they built their games, very much around the impact of that moment and how to make that moment super attractive and compelling that you want to see more of it. They took that, I think, into into PlayStation games with that same kind of sensibility, very artisanal or very craft-like in how they would build every moment to be itself a little jewel, but again, to propel you further into the game. I think a lot of Western games rely more on big epic moments with a lot of running through the forest between them. And that's kind of a different stylistic take on the building of it. I know now it's going to go out there and get all kinds of comments about people telling me that I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But I'm just, from my experience, when I look at it, that's what I see. I see a lot more attention to detail in the Japanese game development experience, which conversely made it really hard at the time for the Japanese game developers to move onto a platform like PS3, which had a very complicated architecture. Sorry guys. And there was a cost of entry to get into that. It was going to take more people to build games for that. And the Japanese teams are typically as small as they can be to get a thing done. So that leap was hard. And I think that whole PS3 generation was a tough time for most Japanese developers who are looking at the real intricacies of the game development experience. But boom, now you're on Blu-ray disc. You have infinite space to build your game out into. So it was a quick on-ramp, I think, for high-end PC developers in the West to move into the console space because there's more perhaps continuity between those two development environments. But that said, I think the Japanese development community came back on PS4. They've got some great games in that generation that once they've conquered the enormity of the dev challenge, then they can get back still with their attention detail and create some of the titles you see coming from places like From Software.
Yeah, and it also feels like with the West, maybe there's a bit more Hollywood influence within how the production works in terms of chasing photorealism and the whole cinematic narrative thing, which obviously adds a lot to the cost in terms of the development of a game.
Absolutely. Well, in the West, go big or go home. Is that what they say?
Oh, yeah.
And everything just got enormous in its scope and its reach and its ambition. And to your point, that brings a lot of costs associated with it because the only costs involved in game development is just labor over time. Maybe if you have like an NFL license, there's a cost there or a FIFA license. But other than that, if you're making any sort of non-IP, you're not stealing an IP from movies or comic books, just going ahead with a game project, the only cost involved is labor against time. So as games get bigger, requires bigger teams to spend more time to make the game. And that's how costs just escalate almost exponentially.
But also, American salaries are usually some of the highest in the world, particularly in the metropolises, right? So that adds a lot to the game cost. I imagine a team Asobi would probably be a much cheaper studio to run than, say, Naughty Dog, which is in LA.
Yes, there are environmental factors which will impact your cost structure. And the cost of making a game in LA versus Liverpool versus Tokyo are dramatically different. But at the same time, someone asked me, well, Sean, I see all of your studios in the very expensive West Coast of America. Have you ever thought of like relocating your studios to a lower cost base area? And I said, well, Hollywood's in Hollywood for a reason, and the music industry is in New York for a reason, and the game industry, for right or for wrong, now the center of gravity is the West Coast of America. Here you go, your comments are going to go exploding now after me saying that. But that's where the concentration of talent is, particularly once it became a networked experience, once it became a multiplayer experience. That's when the technical expertise found in Silicon Valley and emanating from there, the LA basin, up in Seattle. There are a lot of teams there who can build at that scale, who can create that sort of online experience multiplayer thing, which is tricky and hard to do. But that's where it began. I think a lot of companies felt that this is where they have to set their major development studios just to stay not only in the zeitgeist of that, but that's where the talent pool is. You could set up a low-cost studio in Montana, but you just be have a hell of a time recruiting for it.
Was there ever a cost analysis done in terms of how much a studio loses in terms of money based on a game developer's commute time into work. Because I spoke to a former Naughty Dog developer maybe a year ago, and he told me that there are a number of people at Naughty Dog that commute 2.5 hours each way to work. So by the time you get to work, you're probably going to have mental fatigue, which leads to lower productivity.
I guess I was fortunate now in hindsight that when I retired from the gaming industry, it was the end of 2019.
You timed it perfectly.
Yes, because somehow I
Perfectly.
knew, right?
Yeah. Clairvoyant.
Someone phoned me. And so I stepped down 2 months before, 3 months before lockdown. And until we had lockdown, it had been my position, and this is because I'm a boomer and I come from that older generation. When I was running studios, work from home was not an option. Work from home could happen if you have a sick child, or you've got a dentist appointment, or you're waiting for someone to deliver a refrigerator or something. You know, kind of ad hoc in the moment
Yeah.
arrangements to take a couple of days and just log on was fine. But the idea of having every Thursday everyone's going to be working from home, that was not in my mindset. I felt that could not be successful. So I was old and stodgy about not approving scheduled work from home days. The pandemic changed the whole thing. In a minute, boom, everybody had to work from home. Again, I didn't see that on the coal face. I was, at home on my sofa. But that then changed a bunch of dynamics. People began to realize, the long commute, you move to a bigger house, you have kids, you want to be in a school, you move a little further out, a little further out. It's like the boiling frog phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's like all of a sudden, damn, I'm commuting 2 hours a day. How did that happen? It's almost like work hours too. You start doing 9 to 5 and then you end up doing 7 to 10. And you don't really know how you got there. You just kind of worked longer hours and longer hours and longer hours. And then it was 18-hour days. So I don't know if study has been done, particularly on the commute impact on productivity. Certainly wasn't when I was there because it wasn't didn't have to. But I'm sure there has been stuff done now in the wake of not only lockdown, what does hybrid look like, and how many days a week do people have to be in the office? And frankly, Reese, I'm glad I'm not dealing with any of that right now.
Well, it seems to be a point of contention. There are certain individuals, people like Elon Musk, that saying, no, you need to work 5 days a week back in the office. But I feel like the genie's out of the bottle. Like, you don't know
Yes.
what you don't know. So people didn't
Yes.
know before, but now that they've gotten a taste of it, it would be
Right.
very hard to try and get people to go back to the office full time.
Completely. Again, I'm the old boomer guy, so in my days, it felt like this job cannot be done remotely. This job has to be 200 people in this huge studio working, cheek to jowl to get the game out. And then the pandemic forced it to happen. And then all of a sudden, guess what? Games are still shipping. Games are still being built. People aren't coming to the office. And you're right. The genie's out the bottle on that one. And no longer can an executive like me stand up there and say, games cannot be built remotely, because they obviously can.
Love how self-aware you are. You're very in tune with what people think about you and your own flaws and your own strengths and weaknesses. I mean, I know you've even acknowledged that because you've spoken about diminishing returns and games chasing the realistic trend. And people are like, well, you initiated that. You pushed for Horizon and Last of Us and stuff. But were you aware of that at the time? Were you aware of like where this would potentially end up in terms of like, oh, hang on, this isn't sustainable?
There's a cognitive dissonance that can occur and probably is required for most executives. Can you hold two opposing ideas in your head at the same time? One idea in my head at the time was, wow, this expense curve is extreme. We're doubling the cost of development every generation of hardware. But over here, half my brain says, this game looks so awesome, though. So we just get behind it. We'll find a way to pull the money together. We'll get this thing done. It's going to be amazing. So balancing those two ideas in my head at the same time, that yes, I'm kind of pushing the cost curve out because of what we're trying to achieve here. But I know that over time, this is going to be an albatross around the neck of the industry. And then I think with PS5, we probably turned the corner on that, and we are in a very expensive game right now. And the fact that there's been no meaningful movement on the price of a game since I started in this industry 25 years ago.
Yeah.
PS1 games, $59.99, and cost as little as $1 million to make a PS1 game. And even the big hitters back then would cost you $10 million to make. And then now, in the world of infinite memory and amazing GPU and CPU power, you see games costing in excess of $200 million already,
Which is
and still
crazy.
only be able to, and still can only charge $59.99.
But there's a sliding scale in terms of pricing as well, right? Because if on one end you've got, say, Ubisoft that a month after release, they heavily discount a game. And then you got Nintendo all the way on the other, where them discounting a game is like finding the Holy Grail. It like never happens. So obviously there is a scale in terms of the pricing model. How did Sony decide on its pricing and when to discount something and how long to keep it at the price that it's at, especially these days?
Well, at the beginning, we hardly discounted anything in PlayStation 1. It was going out at $59.99 for the majority of the time in market, or the majority of the sales moments were at full price. And then we started to do $49.99 down to $29.99 through PS2, and then in PS3, I think that curve it accelerated the moving the price moving the prices accelerated. And certainly in a digital world where you're dealing with PlayStation Store products or products that you're going to download, and those prices can change more dynamically because it's just in one store where you command all of it. It's more difficult when you have retail units out in the field, and you can't, as a manufacturer, influence what Best Buy is going to do with their pricing structure. They can mark it down if they want to. So it's difficult. Well, we cannot control the pricing in the physical marketplace, but the digital marketplace is under control of the platform that holds it. So I think there's more flexibility around that. I think people try different price points at different times for different things. And there's no particular pattern of success that people can follow and say, this works every time. You come out at full price, and then exactly 47 days later, you drop it down $10. And then 2 months later, you drop it down half price. There's no definition about what is the best path for that. It's so dependent on the title and the kind of success it's having or not, as the case may be, in those pricing decisions. And I think the problem with that is not dropping the price. The problem is there a way to raise the price? I mean, that's why you see so much emphasis on microtransactions or downloadable content or season passes or battle passes, or these are all ways to generate more revenue off the $60 product to help ameliorate against the rising dev costs.
Yeah.
But not every game can use those tools. Not every game is appropriate with those added value propositions. So it's a bit of a mess right now, actually.
Well, you have mentioned before about how the finance sector in the actual gaming world is trying to stop that curve being like this, right? The peaks and valleys, and that's partly why maybe the games as a service model came to be. To kind of get constant revenue, but it looks like that's having problems as well. I mean, Concord was a disaster for Sony. How
I'll
does
let that
it?
one hang right there.
Yeah, what's that? Yeah, well, I'm
I'll
just.
just let that comment hang out there.
Well, I'm trying to understand how you get to that point, because there must have been a lot of data that they were looking at, and they must have done like online testing and so forth to kind of gauge what the feedback is and how popular they think it might be. So I don't actually understand how those type of scenarios happen.
Games as a service, live service gaming, games, we used to call it persistent world. There's all these different ways to describe that. It's just a place that people will log on to on a regular cadence and maybe buy something for their character or buy something to give them ability in the game of some kind. And people enjoy that. Fortnite is the poster child for that entire business and how that works. And a lot of people saw that, so that's amazing because you have the same game out there. You're not spending money on developing a new game. You're just sort of feeding the monster you've created. And with standard, subscription models or a robust DLC component to it, you can modulate or mediate that peak and valley issue that you're talking about earlier. You have this steady revenue coming through across that, and that's a financial model that's super healthy, super great. Everyone loves that. The problem we see in the market is, and this we didn't have the data on this before, so we're kind of learning this in real time, I believe, is the charitable answer, is that how many live service games can be successful at any one moment?
Yeah, well, there's
The
only a
answer
certain
obviously
amount of
is not
people.
20. Yeah, a certain amount of people, and coming up with the next great live service game, you have to not only have a great game, you have to compel people to take their time away from where they are to come over and invest time in where you are. There's a switching cost. I don't think a lot of people play four or five live service games at the same time.
No.
You're like all into one or two, and that's it. And so for you to come out with another one, you're trying to get people to come over here, stop spending so much time doing that thing you love, and come over here and try this thing you don't know. And that's a hard proposition. It's not just the selling of the game. It's convincing people that they should take away some of the time they're really enjoying doing this thing over there to come over to your unknown thing and invest their time there. And it's not like a single player game or a narrative play game. It's like I can do my live service thing with you, but I'm gonna just play Elden Ring and just to see that whole experience and get the thing done and go yay, and then go back to where I'm having my daily hit of Fortnite or whatever it is. So I think a lot of people looked at that model and said that's really healthy, that's really it's high profitability. But the market can only absorb so much at any given time. And I think that's why there's several companies who have launched their live service games in the last 12 months who have pretty much pulled the plug on them before the year is out. If you just can't get traction at the start, it's very, very hard to prop that thing up without it.
I saw that the PS5 Pro is diskless. With that being said, do you think the PS6 will be completely diskless? Because Sony could probably get away with it now.
Well, actually, I don't think Sony can get away with it now. I think, Xbox has had more success in pursuing that strategy, but Xbox is really most successful in their business in a clutch of countries: U.S., Canada,
Yeah.
U.K., Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. Not coincidentally enough, all English-speaking countries.
Yeah.
Sony, which is the number one platform in probably 170 countries around the world, has an obligation or responsibility to say, if we go discless, how much of my market is not able to make that jump? Can users in rural Italy get a decent connection to enjoy games? One thing I didn't realize when we talked about this in PlayStation 4 about going discless, one person said, one of not the biggest, but there is a significant market for PlayStation consoles, with like athletes like to take them with them because they have so much downtime in hotels before their game,
True.
and they're not supposed to go out drinking or carousing. Stay in your room.
Yep.
It's curfew, 10 p.m. before game time. They're all taking their consoles with them. Actually, there's a huge market. PlayStation is very popular on military bases around the world, places where you can't get an internet connection. So the ability to go to diskless solution is really the key points of that is which part of your market cannot be served by that? Which part of your market will be damaged by going to a diskless market? I'm sure they're doing the research on it. And there will be a tipping point where there's some percentage where you can say, okay, that's fine. We can turn our back on that part of the market. But Sony's market is globally so huge, I think it'd be hard for them to go fully diskless, even with the next generation.
I mean, there are rumors of Microsoft and Sony working on a handheld, which is, I think, prompted by the Switch's success. But that would have to, well, it might not be diskless, but would have to be cartridge based, but it would be the same sort of problem.
Yeah, I think I've heard the same rumors. I've got no
No idea.
information left or right of that. All I will say is, I've launched a few handhelds in my career, and they can be super successful or completely irrelevant. And it's a tough business to get into, and I guess you've got to answer the question is with anything, is what problem are you solving? Is there a large hue and cry to get a portable experience other than a Switch or other than like a Steam Deck? I don't know how big that addressable market is.
Yeah.
And do you have the development resources to provide a robust content pipeline to support it?
Well, I mean, Nintendo is quite different to PlayStation, right? Where I think,
Certainly.
because Nintendo, I think 86% or something of their sales are first party, whereas I think it's 23% on PlayStation consoles. So
Or less, yeah.
So Sony is very much known as the third party system. And so if you don't have third parties jumping on board, then it's very hard to make sales. And
Correct.
I think that's part of the problem you guys had with the PS Vita.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we had some problem with that. The Vita was expensive for what you got. There's some arguments we made that it was over-engineered. With PSP, what we wanted with PSP 2, which never came around, it became the Vita. All we wanted was one more stick. Just wanted one more stick because it only had the one joystick. And Vita gave us both sticks. That was great. But it introduced some innovations that were not well accepted by the market. Proprietary memory card was not a big crowd pleaser because people had a whole drawer of like SD cards at home for every digital camera they bought, but they couldn't use any of the cards they had. They'd have to buy a particular Vita memory card, which is a hard topic to broach. And while back touch was an interesting feature on it, incorporating it into gameplay was tricky. And for a lot of third parties who were trying to do Game Boy and Vita versions of their games, incorporating the back touch was going to be a feature that wasn't going to be on the other handheld platform. So why support that? So I think there were a lot of technology and costs that were built into it, which probably made it more difficult to become successful.
Yeah, makes sense. This is kind of a theoretical question, but so Super Smash Bros. Has pretty much evolved from a celebration of Nintendo to basically the video game Hall of Fame for characters. But there is a glaring omission, which is obviously Sony characters. And that became even more abundantly clear to me after playing Astro Bot, because I'm like, there are so many characters here. Do you think there's ever a scenario where you could see Kratos appear in something like that? I mean, you guys tried to do the PlayStation All-Stars thing as well. But do you think that's a scenario that can ever happen, or do you just think, no, they're competitors, that'll never
I
happen?
think we'll never say never, right? There could be other dynamic changes in the marketplace where old time rivals become, new age partners. Who knows what happens? And I'm not trying to tease anything out there to your audience because I don't know anything about that. But right now, today, I think that's a non-starter as a proposition.
But you were there during the whole PlayStation All-Stars thing.
Yes.
And what was it like working on that game? Because it didn't sell well, did it? And it would have cost a lot because of licensing, all the different third parties.
It depends. Some third parties participated just for their own exposure, to be in that game. And so I don't think there's a lot of money changing hands on everybody who was in the game. At that time, I was doing my sales and my 10 dark years in sales and marketing. So I wasn't really involved on the dev side of things for that particular title. So I'm not exactly sure what the business model was around that. But I think People who love it really loved it.
Yeah, I loved it.
But maybe it came to the market at a time where, to your point earlier about FOMO, where people were spending more attention getting onto these epic, massive action adventure games, whether they be in the Grand Theft Auto world or whether it's like the Resident Evil world or those sorts of types of things. Perhaps at that time in the marketplace, there wasn't really a robust audience for the multiple character brawler kind of action kind of platformer game.
Yeah.
And because the game itself was well achieved, again, the people who loved it really loved it. Maybe it just came to market at a time where that was a difficult genre to sell.
Yeah, because it's interesting because obviously Final Fantasy VII is intertwined with PlayStation. That's
Oh
why
yeah.
it kind of broke the internet in a way when both Sephiroth and Cloud appeared in Smash Brothers, but they never appeared in PlayStation All-Stars. And if I recall, like only Cloud's sword, I think, appeared in Astrobot as well. So I've never really understood why that is, because when I think Final Fantasy, I think PlayStation, really.
Right, even though the franchise began on Nintendo.
Yeah, it did begin on Nintendo, but you guys, with your awesome negotiating skills, yeah, you got them
Yeah. Well, you got to be in the room when it happens, and I wasn't in that room when it happened, so I don't have a view on that.
I have a few questions from my followers that maybe you can answer.
Okay.
Maybe you cannot. Maybe you'll be like, no comment. But
I'll let you know.
we'll see how we go. So this one's from FBNL. As the younger generations appear to be very entrenched on live service platforms such as Fortnite and Roblox, how do you see the rest of the industry adapting to this as those players get older?
Well, I think any game player who's serious about gaming wants to try different things over time. I mean, we may go way down the rabbit hole and maybe just playing FIFA every day for a year. But as we get older, we want to try different things and new experiences. So I think in time they will come out and to try other games that are around us. But you're right, it's taking up a lot of their time now. It's absorbing a lot of energy from the game market that's not going to other games that are coming out. It'll be interesting. I think, we were talking the other day with another person about how 17-year-olds in 2025 are so different from 17-year-olds in 2005.
For sure.
We talk about demographics. Well, this is the 17 to 24 demographic. This is the 32 to 38 demographic. But we've got to understand those definitions, which we made 20 years ago, really don't apply today. And I think the business is entrenched in some old style demographic marketing, which may have been relevant 15 years ago. They've really got to pull out and take a brand new look at who the gamers are. What are they playing? Why are they playing? I'm sure people are saying, we're doing a lot of that research. Yeah, but are you asking the right questions? It's a different market. I didn't have to compete against TikTok for players' times when I was making games. I'd have to compete against all the social media platforms that were out there at the time. That is the problem because of all the, we think we have infinite money and infinite capabilities and more teraflops than you can shake a stick at. There's still only 24 hours in the day. And that's the biggest competitive field is people's time. And people are very stingy with their time, rightly so. So to get them out of the thing they love doing, you have to present them with something better. And there's just more things to fight against now than there was, 10 years ago.
And I'd argue people's attention spans are dropping as well.
Yeah. Well, if you get all of your stimulation from 17 second TikTok feeds, it does impact you.
Cool. Next question is from Flying Plant Whale 545. Interesting name. What is Sean's opinion on Microsoft's latest business strategy of making their IPs multi-platform? And will it increase or diminish Xbox brand value in the eyes of gamers?
Multi-platform is a strategy. Multi-platform, particularly in a world where the cost of development is
So high.
increasing dramatically, multi-platform means widening your addressable market, as the marketing guys say, just getting more people a chance to see it. So I certainly can understand, appreciate, and welcome that ability to have Xbox games appearing on other platforms. What it does do to their brand, I think, yeah, it makes the conversation harder to create what you mentioned earlier is the FOMO. How do you create the FOMO? Trying to do that by bringing everyone to your platform, saying, if you're not here, you're missing out. But if it's available on all platforms, that's one of your marketing tactics you can't use. You can't say it's only available here if it's available everywhere. So it's a balancing act, right? I'm increasing my addressable market. Yay, that's good. I'm making it harder to sell the only on my platform story over here. So we've seen it before. I mean, I was in the business when Sega brought their Dreamcast titles to PlayStation 2. And in time, then Sega became a software-only company and have done a great transformation in that respect, let's be honest. They're doing great.
Yeah.
So it does have historical precedence.
It's interesting because if I take a step back and I try to look at this objectively, I feel like Nintendo is probably the best position to navigate going forward because they don't chase realistic graphics. They tend to have quite conservative budgets, and they're very much able to create FOMO, and able to keep their costs down compared to everyone else. Would you agree?
Yeah, well, I think in a way Nintendo has created its own lane.
Private Idaho, as you call
You've been listening to my other work.
it.
Yes, and it's probably bigger than Idaho. It's huge. Their fans are loyal. They have made so many iconic moments in the world of gaming writ large that everyone respects Nintendo. They're a competitor, but you respect everything they've done to create this industry that now we all enjoy and love. So I think they'll keep on keeping on in the way they do it. They've got the right people around it, the right attitude around it. To your point, during the pandemic, a lot of developers ramped up hiring in order to take advantage of this spike in game revenue, went up like 20%, year on
Yeah,
year.
it's crazy.
And then, of course, once the pandemic was over and people weren't like tied to their living room, those dropped. So we've seen a lot of reaction in the game development world of reducing staff, given the reduction of the somewhat decline in the revenues of the marketplace, given the anomaly which was the pandemic. I think the whole thing Nintendo just kind of rode their plan.
Yeah.
Their plan pre-pandemic, through pandemic, post-pandemic, it was the plan. They didn't think that this was a time to jump up and spend a bunch of money because people were more spending more time at home. And in hindsight, they were right. But of course, they've been in this business a long time. They've seen
They
all
have.
the peaks and valleys, and they've learned how they ride through this thing, and they were successful, and they will continue to be successful. But as you always said, the most common two console stack up in anyone's living room is a Nintendo machine and a Sony machine,
Definitely.
because they seem to scratch two different itches.
They do. And it looks like Nintendo are taking a page out of Sony's book by actually using numbers now, since we have Switch 2. So they've obviously learned. They're like, oh, maybe we should follow what Sony set here in terms of a precedent. So
Yeah, because they've created so much brand value in the word switch. Why would you mess with that?
yeah, it makes perfect sense. Okay, final question before I let you go.
Okay.
Okay, so what game genres? Oh, this is from Official Mod Zero, by the way. What game genres did you think were going to be big hitters but ended up turning out to be the opposite? How were the postmortems for those types of initiatives conducted? And how often heavily did those lessons factor into future decision making? This is a doozy.
Yeah, that's a whole Harvard Business Review article right there.
It is
So,
Official Mod Zero.
yeah, Official Mod Zero. I'll give you a piece of the answer. You can do the rest of the research on your own. We believe that at the time that when I was in London, We had a couple of hardware innovations, actually more than that. There's some we didn't go forward with, but SingStar and using USB microphones to have that karaoke experience
Yeah.
on the one hand, and the iToy camera. This is before Kinect on the Xbox and all of that. We had a camera. We had iToy games. We had iToy boxing and iToy sports games. And later on, we had iPet, where you had like this virtual pet on your TV that could be in your living room because we used the camera to shoot that whole thing.
Yeah.
Really kind of thought that the camera thing was going to be a real super game changer. And it was successful for a bit. And then folks just kind of got tired of it. And I think people felt a bit sub they felt a bit uncomfortable having this camera in their living room looking at them
Which is fair enough.
while they're playing games. And not everyone wants to see their face on a TV screen, and so while it had an initial jump on the novelty of the experience, it didn't really have enough juice to carry it through successfully over time. People were trying to wrap that into different games, but it wasn't really that successful. SingStar, beyond the SingStar line, the microphones really didn't have a lot of usage. But that was during the days we did SingStar with microphones. Then you had, Guitar Hero with the USB guitar, and you had Rock Band with USB guitars and drums and basses. And those were all super successful for a hot minute. And then the market went away from it. It was a novelty. It was something we hadn't done before, but it wasn't something that people just wanted to continue to do, for the rest of their gaming career. So the postmortem is try the postmortem is yes, new things are good, but also understand that new things may grab a novelty moment. It doesn't mean they're going to grab a long legacy moment. And to understand when to turn off the faucet,
Yeah.
basically. It's like the bloom is coming off the rose. So instead of doing, let's do four more games to try to keep that market elevated, let's just look at it and say, this is the natural decay curve on impressive novelties, which grab a lot of attention. It's like Wii Fit. Remember when that was a thing?
Yeah.
That kind of blew the Wii market up by millions of units that people bought. People who are not gamers bought into Wii and Wii Fit because, of course, at Christmas time, you thought you could like lose some weight after all the feasting, but the market went off that as well, just like rowing machines and the treadmill. Over time, people stopped using it. So, understanding what are unique opportunities in the moment to capture or create a market that may explode, but then try to understand quickly: is this a novelty, or is this extendable? Are we just enjoying a moment in the sun, or have we changed and created an entire new genre? And as ever, whether it's in games, music, or movies, it's difficult to know when the right time to get off the horse is.
Well, I'm of the view, and you probably agree, that you learn more from your failures than your successes, because it kind of forces you to take a step back and you have to humble yourself, and hubris fully goes out the door.
I think success teaches us very little, particularly in entertainment. I mean, success in building a rocket ship is probably, repeatable, and you understand this is the kind of fuel you need, and this is the
Yeah.
aerodynamics of the rocket. But in gaming, you could have a super hit, it goes to the roof, but you can't repeat the phenomenon. I mean, we'd have that phrase in music, right? One hit wonders.
Yep.
If this band came out of nowhere, Haircut 100, Love Plus One, top 10, and then never heard from again. So gaming has the same dynamics around that, and how do we understand that this success was made successful because of these factors? Success is really hard to nail what you actually got right and repeat it. Failure is easy to understand where you got wrong and
Yeah.
to avoid it. So you're right. You learn more from your failures than from your successes, definitely.
Well, that is a good place to wrap up, Sean. This has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out and doing this. Your career is amazing, to say the least. I'm the type of person that looks at someone who's achieved the type of success that you've had and think, what does that person sacrifice to get there? And I know you did a lot of 8 a.m. to midnight shifts in Tokyo and obviously 18-hour days during the PSN hack, and you spend a lot of time on the road and away from your family. So I fully understand the sacrifices you've made for Sony and the industry at large. So thank you so much. As I said before, your retirement is well earned.
Well, thank you, Reese. I appreciate that. It's great to be on your show. Thank you for the invitation. I like to speak to all of our fans where we find them, meet them where they are. And if this makes people think a bit more about gaming and how they can enjoy it or even become part of it, that'll be a good outcome.
Yeah. Have you considered like doing an audiobook or writing a book about your entire career?
Oh, good Lord. Yeah, I think I'll just go for the Netflix miniseries and cut out the middleman.
Or a mini documentary series. There you go. And then someone else edits it.
Well, let's see if I can find the gumption for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.